News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ. It's also airing now at 5 o'clock on FM 105.9 KMJ, and you can always find us online at kmjnow.com. Each week we visit with veterans of World War II, and the idea is to honor them for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories for future perusal and understanding, and along the way learn a thing or two about what it really means to love our country. Sometimes veterans bristle at the name Hometown Heroes because these guys don't think of themselves as heroes, but the idea is that no matter where your hometown is in this great country of ours, there are heroes around you, people who have done a lot more to preserve our freedom than you realize. And today that hometown is Orange Cove, California. If you've ever been to Orange Cove, if your car's broken down there, maybe you took it to Pat's Garage and had it fixed up. But I bet you didn't know the guy behind that name, and Pat's Garage has a pretty good World War II story to tell. We're going to hear some of that today with 86-year-old Pat Cimenti, who on December 7th, 1941, I guess, was right here in Orange Cove. How did that news travel here to Orange Cove? How did you find out?
I was in the 8th grade, and my 8th grade teacher just had us come in from being outside, and he says, you students all sit down. I got some things to tell you. We just got the word that Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor, and that's where I found out.
Did it mean anything to you at the time, or was it kind of...
No, it didn't. It was just kind of a shock. I really didn't pay much attention to it, but then after a while, when things got getting bad, you know, and they sent all the Japanese children that went to school with us, all got sent to these... places in Arizona where they took them. I had some friends that were pretty good people, and I didn't know whether it was right or wrong, and whatever it turned out, I guess it was the best thing for us.
I imagine that was hard to understand when you're in eighth grade and you're friends with all these Japanese Americans who are in the same kind of businesses as you are. They're just kids in the neighborhood, and all of a sudden they're enemy aliens. That had to rock your world a little bit.
Yeah, it did. Used to be a family by the name of Nishikawa that had about four boys that went to school there in Orange Cove, you know, from the kindergarten on up. And they were good people, and it's hard to believe that, you know, what happened, but you can't blame them for what happened at that time.
Absolutely. And I guess if you're in eighth grade, maybe it doesn't occur to you that you could be part of this conflict at some point. That was probably the furthest thing from your mind. When did you start to realize, you know what, I may have to do something here?
Yes, we started out above the hardware store there. We had a night, they put us up there on top to listen for airplanes. And whenever we'd find hear an airplane flying, we would call the office in Fresno. We would say the direction that the plane was flying and this and that, you know, and the area that was headed for Fresno mostly. And I don't know whether the little shed is still up on top of the hardware store there or not.
That was your observation deck, huh?
Yeah.
Sounds like a pretty important job at the time. And then when you're at Reedley High School, did you get drafted right when you turned the right age, or how did that work?
When I turned 18 in January, I had to go sign up for the military. And I was a bad boy, didn't do what I was supposed to keep my grades up. And I made a big mistake in my life right there. And I'd say to every child that in that particular type of thing, you study. And that helps a whole lot.
So you didn't have your studies where they needed to be to graduate.
That's right.
But there were other things that you were pretty good at, and they would actually come into play in your military experiences. When did you start working on cars?
Before I got in the service. I started working for an old man by the name of Oberon Eaton in Orange Cove, and I worked for him for a month. And then my neighbor that lived next door to us was Claude McKee, and he had a garage here in town. And while I was overseas, I kept in contact with him, and his wife was writing. My mom couldn't read or write, and they would write letters for her while I was overseas, and got acquainted with him real well. And he asked me if I wanted to go to work for him when I come home from the service. And I wasn't home for a week, and he put me to work.
And the rest is history. That's why Pat's Garage is still here in Orange Cove, and now your son's running it for you. But let's talk about this experience in the Army. So you end up in the Army, and not just in the Army, but in an infantry division. You're in the 75th Infantry. What was your welcome to the Army moment? Did they have to break you in pretty good?
Camp Roberts. They had three or four different pieces of military you could do in the infantry. That would be the cannon company, heavy weapons, rifle company, and medics. I got the cannon company, and the cannon company was pretty good. The only time they needed you, they sent you. They got you out of the front and took you back, and you fired the cannons, and it was all right. I got into some of the bad and some of the good. I had a brother that was in the Aleutian Islands. Yeah, my oldest brother, he put in 4 years at the Aleutian Islands. He was in an anti-aircraft division, and he was on two islands there, Attu and Kiska, and he was in both of those islands, and he drove a tractor pulling cannons and different things, because it was pretty snowy there. They couldn't get the equipment around, especially the cannons and anti-aircraft.
Well, and you would end up somewhere pretty snowy, too. But I want to hear what it was like for you to leave home and to leave your family behind, not knowing if you were coming back or not. What was your mindset, you think, going overseas?
When I got into New York, it was icicles hanging on the barracks there, and it was really cold. Mm-hmm. And I was there one day, and they put us on the ship, and it was a sister ship to the Queen Mary. I think there was 5,000 of us on that troop ship.
You could have fit the whole town of Orange Cove on there a few times, huh?
I guess. Anyhow, we got about 2 days out of New York, and we had a submarine was trying to catch up with us, and they kept dropping these depth charges, and that kept us awake all night. And I went to the restroom there, and the water was running back and forth, and feces all over the place, and I never was so glad to get out of anything in my life.
Yeah, I guess you hadn't really had a whole lot of experience on ships before that. That probably wasn't too much fun. And once you got to the European continent, what kinds of things were you doing? And did you think that this was something you'd be coming home from, or were you scared out of your mind like so many others?
No, I wasn't really scared. I saw enough of the infantry part of it that the first part was with the cannons, and then they took us off the cannons. This was a little town of Colmar. It was under General Patton's Third Army, and they had pushed what they called a wedge up into France, and we stopped the wedge.
So this is what we know now as the Battle of the Bulge, starting on December 16th, 1944, on that frozen European continent. And your division, the 75th Infantry Division, became known as the Bulge Busters for your work there. By the way, if you pull up Pat's story on KMJNow.com, you'll find a link to a terrific 75th Infantry Division website that the son of a veteran has put together. But anyway, back to your story, Pat. You're a little more than 200 miles away from Bastogne, Belgium, but they needed reinforcements there right away, so that's where you went.
The first thing they did was we relieved the 82nd Airborne. Those men had really got a big jar out of that, and they sad looking bunch when we saw them. They, you talk about glad to get out of the front. Well, they were,
which I'm sure wasn't too encouraging for you since you're going in.
Yeah, and the first thing they did was put me out there with a rifle company and spent about 3 or 4 days there, and then they took us back, and I was walking prisoners, German prisoners, from the front to the railroad cars, and we're loading them up on the railroad cars and packing them out of there. It was cold and miserable. I hated to leave the boys up front and me take the prisoners, because I was the youngest kid in the whole company. And most of them were college kids that were drafted.
Yeah, I have to imagine this was pretty eye-opening, because here you are, not quite 19 years old, and you're half a world away in the coldest winter they've ever had there, not knowing if you're going to live or not. When you were with that cannon company and actually participating in the combat, what were those moments like? What kinds of things were you responsible for?
Well, I was responsible for a 50 caliber machine gun. I guess the guy that was rifleman for that was got killed, and I was a replacement for him. Before I joined the company, as a replacement. I rode train cars until I got a certain distance from the front, and then they come and picked us up. And in behind this field hospital, there was a great big cherry tree, and there was children playing under that tree when I got there, and they dropped me off, and they left in a hurry. Well, they must have known what was going to happen, because they started shelling the area where I unloaded. And my barracks bag was there, and about three rounds come and hit the tops of these trees, and these three little kids were crying and screaming, and that was a part of my life I hate to think about. Anyhow, there's children that's crying, and I banged on the back of the door and got their attention inside, and we took the kids inside, and they were bleeding all over from shrapnel from the shells, and you talk about, that was hard to take right off.
Yeah, and it sounds like there probably wasn't a whole lot you could do for them, huh?
No, it wasn't. I tried a first aid, and I didn't have nothing to stop their bleeding, and they were screaming and yelling, and as soon as the nurses come out of this aid station, they took them inside, and that was the last I saw them, but some of them were pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And then shortly after that happened, I ran under this railroad car, and it was a flat car, and I got in behind that thing, and I was scared to death. And after I took the kids in there, they started shelling again, and we had about four or five more rounds of 88. After I got situated under that railroad car, I got as close to the axle as I could, and about four more rounds fell in all around us, and luckily I didn't get hit. About that time, here come the colonel, our regimental colonel. I come out from under that railroad car, and he looked at me, and he said, "Soldier, where in the hell do you think you're at?" And I says, "Well, I don't know where the hell I'm at." And he says, that was the wrong thing to say to that colonel. And he says, "Where's your helmet?" I said, "It's under that railroad car. You go get that helmet right now, and you go bring it out here, and you put it on right in front of me, and don't you ever take it off again while you're in the area." And I said, "Okay, yes, sir." I never saw him again until I went into the company area. And I get into the company area, and sergeant's kind of telling me what's here and what's there. And he says, "I think you were sent as a 50 caliber machine gun operator." And I said, "Yes, I've done quite a bit of that in basic training." And he says, "Well, you got a job. There's a box in the back of the weapons carrier back there." And he says, "You go get that box, and there's a 50 caliber machine gun in the box. And I want you to put it up out there and dig a round circle, put the machine gun in the circle, and cover it with these pine valves and stuff, and camouflage it." Okay. And I get it all done. I had the gun in on the tripod. Here come that colonel that just chewed me out. And he said, "Who's in charge of that 50 caliber machine gun?" And he looked at the sergeant, says, "That man right over there." He said, "Pat, come over here." He looked at me and he said, "Are you in charge of that 50 caliber machine gun?" I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "You show me how you're going to operate it." Okay. I sat down in front of the thing, and I reached down to grab the bolt, mm-hmm. and it wasn't there. And boy, you talk about falling down and getting scared to death. And I just, this old guy's got it in for me, boy. Something else.
So how'd you get out of that situation?
He made me go get the bolt that screws into the side of the case and put it on there and show him how I was going to put the shells in the gun. He said, "I don't want you to put one in there now, but," he said, "you show me how you're going to do it." And I held it up there and pulled the bolt back and slammed it back. And he says, "Okay." He looked at me kind of funny. He said, "You know, I think you learned a little something, didn't you?" And I said, "Yeah, I sure did."
And I'm sure you had your helmet on too, right?
Oh, yeah, I had it on that time. Steel one, too.
Yeah, I don't blame you one bit. We're getting a taste of what it was like to be on the ground in Europe with the Bulge Busters of the 75th Infantry Division. And there's a lot more to come with 86-year-old Pat Cimenti of Orange Cove, California. There are a couple scars on his right knee that we'll hear the story behind. Some more close calls and interesting twists of fate. Go to KMJNow.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook to check out some photos from way back when and also see what Pat and his wife of 64 years, Joy, look like today. Hometown Heroes will be right back after I tell you a little bit about some of our supporters of this program, like Fresno Distributing.
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno T.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 of the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Continuing now with 86-year-old Pat Chimenti of Orange Cove, California. He served in the 290th Infantry Regiment of the 75th Infantry Division, famous for their contributions at the Battle of the Bulge, a battle as famous for the brutal weather conditions as much as the intense fighting between Allied and German forces in World War II. It lasted from mid-December 1944 through the end of January 1945. 19,000 Americans, 19,000 died in those 41 days. 47,000 more were wounded in the Battle of the Bulge, and that total technically does not include our guest today, even though he was wounded. He does not have a Purple Heart medal, but he does have some scars that remind him of the incident. If you go to KMJNow.com, you'll find a photo that shows Pat and two other men on a 105-millimeter howitzer crew. Pat is standing in the back right. He was the loader on that crew. Thing is, when you're firing a gun like that, you're also a target, right, Pat?
We got shelled, and the Germans poured in about 10 rounds of 88-millimeter, and that was their favorite gun, I guess. And it hit the ammo pile, okay? And I'm grabbing the ammo and bringing it over and putting it in the stack right by the gun so I can, and I come to one gun and the whole tip was blown off of it.
So this is one of your shells for the 105-millimeter howitzer you were loading. The incoming German shell had blown off the tip but not set off the explosive material that's now exposed in that live round in your pile.
They looked at me and he says, the sergeant said, "Chimenti, you get the shell and take it out of here and put it way over there out of the way, and you be careful with that thing. Because you could probably set it off, you know, if you hit it hard enough to make it trip." Kind of scary there for a while. I didn't know what I was up against. But I looked at the shell when I took it, artillery piece is what it is. Right. And the hole where it tapers down in the front, that whole nose piece was all blown off that one round. You know, you never know what's going to happen with it. That's nitroglycerin in the inside of there.
Some nervous moments. In moments like that, or when you're hiding under the railroad car and the shells are coming in, what goes through your mind?
I don't know. The only thing I had was I was loading it one of those cannons, and this same day that the artillery hit the stack of cartridges that you load up, you know. Anyhow, I was running back and forth, and I felt a little sting in my leg, but it didn't bother me, you know, and I said, I won't worry about it. And I, after it was all over with, and we were all talking and standing around, and I went like this, and the blood had gone down, got into my boot, and I didn't even know I was hit. It went in my knee here.
So it went in on one side of your knee and came out the other.
The other, yeah. And all the blood had gone down and got into my combat boot, you know. And
you didn't know you were wounded until you heard something squishy.
Yeah, the dumbest thing I ever seen. And I went to the aid station, and they put a bandage on it, and it said, you go back to your company. He says, you ain't hurt. Uh-huh. And that didn't hit. He says, did it hurt you? No. Did it hurt you to walk? No. Okay.
And when you look at the scars you just showed me now, what do you think? Because a lot of guys, I mean, an inch away, it could have done a lot more damage. You could have been off the lines. You could have maybe not come home. What do you think of when you see that?
I just wonder how lucky I am.
And I'm sure that wasn't the only close call.
Oh, quite a bit. We captured a glider manufacturing outfit. They tow the gliders up, and they would get them up maybe 10, 12, 13,000 feet and go around and take pictures of our areas, you know. And we were supposed to go in and fix all those gliders so they couldn't use them. So we had these trench knives, and we were just cutting these gliders. And I said, you know, what are they doing that for? You know, it didn't make sense. But then you stop and think about it. What if they had to come back and pick up the gliders? There must have been 15 or 20 of those. They were manufacturing them for the military to tow behind these planes.
And it was while raiding this glider factory that you ended up posing for one of the more unique photos that I have posted in your album on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I don't know if you guys are really doing what it looks like you're doing there, but you have four American soldiers, yourself included, all gathered around a large flag with that infamous swastika right in the middle, and you four GIs are all holding your hands in front of your midsections, appearing to aim something at that flag.
This swastika flag was flying at the, when we captured the thing, so we decided we'll take it down and do this.
So with the gliders, you took a knife and knifed through it, but you decided urination on the swastika would be a better move.
See them faces on them guys there?
I understand you're not actually relieving yourselves on the flag, just pretending to, huh?
No, it's just pretending to.
Some good, clean fun by those guys there. Do you know what happened to that flag?
No, I don't. I don't know what happened to it.
I imagine that photo's been a conversation piece over the years.
Well, we weren't supposed to take pictures, you know, and put them around like this.
Let's talk a little more about the Battle of the Bulge, because certainly since then, I'm sure you have grown to understand the importance of that time in history. And I'm sure at the time, you certainly felt the bitter cold. How did you deal? How did you sleep at night with those freezing temperatures?
Not very good. I tell you, I dug a hole, I bet you 3 feet deep, maybe more, 4 foot deep, and covered it on the bottom with pine boughs and everything. And I had my sleeping bag and raked up all the pine cones I could and put it down and made me a thing so I wouldn't be so cold. It was still, you got cold. We would take this little canned heat in these little cans, you know, Sterno, yeah. And we'd put them in a bag.
Had to try something to stay warm, huh?
Yeah.
What do you think was the most difficult thing for you to deal with during that time period when there was so much carnage? You're a replacement, which tells you the guys before you were beat up pretty bad. The weather is as big of an opponent as the enemy is, and I'm sure you didn't know when this was going to end. So what was the most difficult part of it for you?
Well, the most difficult part was they told me that field artillery outfit, they killed the Germans, captured them and shot them right there. And they took us down there to show us what it was. And
was that at Malmedy?
Yeah. Talk about something that'll turn your stomach and make you mad. Well, that's what it was intended for it to do. And changed a lot of things in my mind, I'll tell you, about the Germans. Of course, we did some of the same thing, too. But
this is what's known now as the Malmedy Massacre, where they just gunned down all these Americans, and then they left the bodies there in the snow. And so you guys were taken there to see the aftermath?
Yeah, aftermath, yes. That's bad.
And it sounds like, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I'm getting from you is not so much that it made you afraid that you could suffer the same fate, but that it built up some righteous anger in you that whoever did this to these Americans needed to pay for it?
Yes, definitely. And it changed my attitude toward the German prisoners, too, until I had to be around them for a while before I could. I had German prisoners that worked under me in Paris in the motor pool.
Yeah, and there's a good story about how that came about. You know, you were saying earlier, kids stay in school because you didn't and it changed your life. But the fact that you were so good with automobiles and as a mechanic kind of changed the course of your military service. Tell me about how that got started.
It got started from Mr. Don Fair, that was the auto mechanics teacher in Reedley High School. He had this school bus that the brakes were getting hot. He knew what was the matter with us, but he took us all out to see what we could figure out why this brakes were getting hot. He made us drive the bus around the school about two or three times, so that putting the brakes off and on, off and on, off and on. And this would build up the fluid in the brake cylinders. That little bus was, the brakes were just smoking on it after we drove it around the block and back. And he said, now all you guys look under there and see how many of those wheels are smoking. And he said, they're all smoking. Okay, now what do you suppose makes them do that? And he says, you've all had a little schooling on master cylinders. And he says, what's that supposed to be, loose or tight? And I said, well, it's supposed to be have enough clearance in there to let the fluid come back into the master cylinder. And he said, oh, okay. And that just stuck in my head. And when this happened on this trip going to Paris from Sarrebourg, France, after the war was over with, they put us in a redeployment camp, and we were making redeployment, cleaned up the trash that they bring in with them, all the GIs. They had so much dogs, cats, and you name it, they had them. And they brought them in from Germany, and we had to do something with the animals. I don't know whatever happened. We made a big cage and put them all into this cage, and the dogs in one, the cats in another.
So you're in a convoy headed to Paris.
We stopped along the road. All four wheels were just smoking. And the lieutenant was up front. He come back, and he said, this is a weapons carrier. And he says, any of you guys know anything about brakes? And I'm saying, oh, no, not again. He looked at it back there, and he says, any of you guys know anything about brakes? I said, I do, sir. And he says, do you think you could get him so we could get to Paris? And I said, yeah, but I don't have no tools to work with. And he says, well, let's take a walk. We'll go down this ranch house, and this rancher might have some tools that would fit that. And I said, oh, okay. We went there and looked all through his toolbox. The only thing we could find was a little old monkey wrench, you know, had an end like this. He said, do you think that'll do it? And I said, well, we can try it. And I took the cap off the bleeder valve, and I got under there, and I couldn't break the one loose. And it just wouldn't, and I stripped the whole outside edge of it. And I went over to the other side, and luckily it broke loose, and it squirted brake fluid about 6 feet away from the. And it was hot, you know, and he says, you could hear the brakes just releasing. And he says, you think we can make it to Paris? And I said, yeah, it's about 35, 40 miles yet. I said, well, if you don't put the foot on the pedal, brake pedal, you make it. And if you start pumping the brakes, you're going to have the same thing again. So he says, okay, went on into Paris, and the 2 days was up, or three, I forget what it is now. And when we started back, we went got another vehicle and put everybody in there, and we made it back all right. And he said, when we got back, he said, I want you to go to the CP and talk to the captain. I said, okay. I went in there, and I don't know what the world these guys want. And he says, I understand you had some brake problems with that weapons carrier. I said, yes, sir. He said, how'd you like to go back to Paris and be the motor pool sergeant? I said, yeah, I'd like that pretty good. And they'd already released the sergeant to go home, and it me back, and they replaced him right away. So the one day was different. I just barely got to talk to him when he was leaving. And he says, you'll be all right. He said, you've got a lot of German prisoners that are working and fixing flat tires and cleaning up the stuff and washing and fixing everything. And
you mentioned moments ago that seeing the aftermath of the Malmedy massacre and realizing what
German troops had done to Americans that it changed your perspective on German prisoners. But now when you're running this motor pool and you have all these German prisoners working under you, how did you get accustomed to that? And when did you realize that these guys were trustworthy, that these guys were people you could count on?
The ones I had must have gone through some kind of a, you know, tool. They're all older men. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want war. The guys tell me, I hated the war. I hated it. And this Willie, this one guy that I had, he was a sergeant, German sergeant. And I had an air compressor that had a bad valve that had burned the exhaust valve in the motor that drives the compressor. I asked him, I said, Willie, you verstehen, do you understand? I get to speak a little German. And I said, do you verstehen the valves? And he said, yeah. He says, ich mag it. I'll make one. So he went over to this machine shop, was next to us, and had a piece of steel about that long, and put it in the lathe. Turned out this exhaust valve, same as that other thing, and just like the one we took out. He knew more about them compressors than I did.
You talked about it changing your perspective before. What about after working with these guys? What kind of understanding and perspective did that give you?
Well, I had one prisoner come in every morning. He was an older guy, probably in his 60s. He would wash my clothes, make my bed, clean up everything in there, just spick and span. And what more could you ask from a man, huh? I had a lot of bad feelings towards the Germans. And, you know, some of those old men are just like I was. They didn't want to fight a war. You know, after the war was over with, they changed their vision about a lot of things. They're just a human like you and I.
War is horrible for everybody on every side, huh?
That is right.
Well, it's time for another quick break, but when we come back, Pat will tell us about coming home from the war and meeting his wife of 64 years now, Joy. We'll also hear about his misadventures in moonlighting as a tank driver. You won't want to miss that story. The rest of Hometown Heroes straight ahead after I tell you a little bit more about our sponsors like Fresno Distributing, where the week-long mega sale event in the parking lot wraps up today. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else. Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course, the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, JennAir, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it. They have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC, Fresno D. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Los Banos at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Los Banos every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Los Banos.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 86-year-old Pat Cimenti of Orange Cove. He's told us about some of his experiences with the 75th Infantry Division. You can check out the story online at kmjnow.com for photos and more information. We've talked about how your expertise as a mechanic earned you a nice assignment with the motor pool there in Paris, but I'm pretty sure tanks were not part of that motor pool. How'd you end up driving a tank?
The sergeant asked me, he said, you know how to drive a tractor? I said, yeah, I drove Caterpillar before I come in the Army. My brother had 20 acres of tomatoes, and I had listed it up with a D4 Caterpillar. And he said, oh, yeah. He said, well, you think you can get that tank moved down there on the river bottom? I said, yeah, I don't know, I can try. So I went down there and put gas in it, and didn't have enough gas in it, and couldn't get the starter to work. The battery was dead. So we got the battery charged up and went back, and I drove it all like from here to that highway over on the other side of town, and I had to turn in as it got into town, and I didn't traverse the barrel of the 88 millimeter sticking way out there, you know, and it punched a hole in the corner of that building. And I thought, oh my God, I'm never going to live this down. And I backed up and started out of there again. And I turned the barrel around. And
so you had the barrel sticking out sideways. It didn't have clearance.
And it poked a hole in this building. So I'm going up over the top of this rock bridge. And it gets just about in the middle, and the whole bottom falls on, right down in the water. The water wasn't not even as deep as that lower part of that TV there. And
so the tank fell into the water, or the rest of the bridge?
Tank. We had to go get a tank retriever to pull it up out of the creek there to get it out. And 10 years later, my buddy that I was in this Army was with, we were in the same little town together. And we were sitting up in the mountains, and he said, you know who that SOB was that run that tank off in there, the creek? And I said, yeah, you're looking at him. And he says, are you for driving that? And I said, yeah.
So first you punched a hole in a building, then you started out.
Oh, my God, I never heard the last of that. Your lieutenant says, you dumb. What's the matter with you guys? You got you. Can't think of anything, I guess, you know.
And the fall that you took in the tank. So you're in the tank, you're driving it, and all of a sudden the bottom gives out. And
fell right off, right down in the creek. It didn't roll forward or back, just swatted right down in there.
But it was only, what, 6 or 8 feet or so?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And that just a, like big chunk on both sides of the tank just collapsed and fell down. And, you know, you stop and think, them thing must weigh it. Forget how much they do weigh, but they're...
It's in the tons.
Yeah, it is in the tons. Yeah, right.
Well, I don't think too many people have been on that ride, except for you.
Yeah.
When you did get to come home from the war, how would you describe what that felt like? Was it relief? Was it elation? Uncertainty? What was it like for you to come back to America after the time you spent overseas?
It was felt good. I mean, when I got off that ship in New York, I went down the Bay Area, and I looked over and saw that Statue of Liberty, and tears came to my eyes. And I said, you know, I've been a long ways from home and fought a lot for my country, and it made me so proud to come home and see that thing still there.
Was it hard in some ways to come home and think about all the men just like you who weren't coming home?
Yes, it was. I had quite a few out of my company. When I first got into the cannon company, we were spending days on the front instead of behind the cannons. That's hard to take, you know, and see men getting hurt and artillery rounds coming in, hauling men back and forth on gurneys, and makes you wonder what the hell is going to be me next or what.
And how do you account for the fact that you weren't next, that you survived those close calls and you came back? Did you feel somebody was looking out for you?
Yes, sir, I sure did. And the old boy upstairs did a lot for me, I'm sure he did.
Well, for one, he brought you back here to Orange Cove, and as you start working for the garage, for Mr. McKee, a garage that you would take over and still says Pat's Garage here in Orange Cove today,
I guess you got a real joyful feeling when you met some pretty young lady around these parts, huh?
Yeah, that bus, the high school bus, used to stop in front of the shop there and unload kids from the parents would pick them up there. And Joy and her girlfriend would stick their head out of the bus and say, "Hi, Pat." And my boss would say, "Hey, you better watch out. You're going to be married here before too long." I never forget that. And then she went to work right across the street. There was a little Italian restaurant across there. She worked as a waitress in there.
But your boss was right. You weren't careful because you did end up married.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we did.
And what's it like to think about now when you see all this memorabilia you brought home from the war? You've got a dagger that a German officer carried on his belt. You've got belt buckles with the Nazi swastikas, a lot of contraband that you brought home from the enemy. You've got photos, papers, all kinds of things that remind you of what you went through and how close you were to not coming back. So when you think about the fact that you never would have met your wife, your two children, five grandchildren, 15 great-grandchildren, never would have been born, what does that make you feel?
It makes you feel good. You know, it really does. It makes you feel better when they all come in the house and start running around and, "Grandpa this and Grandpa that," you know. That's up for you.
And really, you probably didn't know it at the time, but that's really what you were over there fighting for, wasn't it?
That's true. That's true. You get to thinking about it. Yeah, this old United States is a hard place to forget, and it has a lot of memories that I don't think any other country in the world as good as this we are in the United States.
Amen to that. I want to ask you before we wrap it up about this photograph, because I've seen a lot of photographs. Every veteran I've talked to usually has photographs from his time in the service, but they're usually photos that he's had since he got back from the war. And this photo has a different story. We'll put it online. It's a photo of you and two other men around a piece of American artillery. And you saw this photo where?
In Bastogne.
It was taken in Bastogne, Belgium. But you walked into the VA Medical Center in Fresno and saw this on the wall?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's in the basement.
It's in the basement of the VA Medical Center in Fresno, but you never owned a copy of this photo.
No, I didn't. That was taken by, in fact, I'd forgot all about it. The guy, even it was from the news outfit that took the picture.
So you're at the VA in Fresno for an appointment, and you walk past this photo, and how did you react?
God, I know these guys, you know. I said, "That's Joe Lowe and Ed Matsis, and that's me over there."
So all this time, your photo's been on the wall at the VA, and you didn't even know it.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a photo that I'm sure was chosen for that spot on the wall because your buddy Ed there has a very unique expression on his face that kind of, I guess, depicts the violence of what it's like when a shell comes out of one of those?
Yeah, you open your mouth so you don't break your eardrums. And a lot of them, I don't know whether I had my mouth open or not.
Looks like your mouth's closed. You're holding your helmet, though.
I had ear muffs and stuffed in my ears. You open your mouth and that keeps it, when it, see, that's just a little short barrel there on that gun. Actually, it would be classified as a mortar, but it was 105 millimeter howitzer, they called it.
Well, a good thing you're wearing your earplugs, because you've been hearing me just fine throughout this interview, and most guys who spend a lot of time around those guns can't say that. I mentioned all the souvenirs that you have. Is there any one of them that you would say is most meaningful to you and that brings back a specific memory when you see it?
Yeah, it's these right here.
Oh, the photo of urinating on the swastika. Yeah. What do you think that symbolizes?
Well, it symbolizes that it shouldn't have been done. They would probably, if the Germans knew that we were doing that, they would. Of course, their flag means something to them too, you know. And if it was the Stars and Stripes on there, wouldn't you feel like it? You get your butt kicked.
Yeah, no, big time, big time. But I guess in a way it symbolizes who won that war and why it was important for what that flag symbolized to be stopped, huh?
Yes, sir. That's what it symbolizes.
Anything else about your time in the service that we haven't talked about that you think is important for us to know and understand and remember today?
What do you say, for instance, when a grandkid says, "Hey, Grandpa, what was this war all about? And did you have to kill anybody?"
I didn't know whether I might have, but I didn't know I did. And when everybody's firing on a gun, M1, and got a line of guns going off, how you know which one you got or when you haven't got. But I was a pretty good shot when I come to shooting a rifle.
What would you say you're most thankful for today?
Well, going overseas and have my day and come back home. I'm proud of what I've done in my lifetime, and I had a lot of experiences in the service that probably a lot of men would really love it, and I liked the service. The only thing I dislike is I didn't get enough addresses of all the men that I was in my company, and I like these four men there, and everybody in my section, my gun section, I didn't get their thing. And when we got to disbanding the division, everybody went home, and we stayed there because I was a replacement and didn't have enough points to get home.
Was it hard after you got back to adjust to being a civilian again?
Yes. I went into Three Musketeers. I was going to get a beer. I guess the guy looked at me and thought I wasn't old enough to buy a beer. See, he says, I want to see your ID. I showed him my driver's license. And he says, you're only 20 years old. I said, yeah, I can't serve you. Get the hell out of here. It's like that, you know. You know, you don't forget things like that.
You felt, hey, do you know what I just did halfway across the world so you could have this place?
Yeah. Well,
on behalf of all our listeners, I just want to say thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us some of those stories.
You're welcome. Glad to be able to share some of it with you. It makes you feel pretty good when people like you come around and ask you these questions and care enough about it to have you come around and let them know what you've been through, for crying out loud. I'm proud of what I did. I didn't do a whole lot, but I got quite a bit done. I think I served my country good, and it served me pretty good. In fact, real good. That's about all I got to say.
All right, one last question. When I meet veterans who have been married as long as you have, and most of the people I interview have, believe it or not, I always have to ask, what's the secret? What's the secret to being married for 64 years?
Being able to control your temper. That's ever you got to give and take.
Fair enough. Short and sweet advice for the rest of us aspiring to marriages that stand the test of time, like Pat and Joy Chimentis has. I had a beautiful drive out through the Blossom Trail to Orange Cove with those snow-capped Sierra peaks in the distance. What a gorgeous time of year here in the Central Valley. I had an even better time visiting with this hometown hero. If you have a hero in your hometown that you want to let me know about, shoot me an email, paul@kmjnow.com. That's paul@kmjnow.com. And please join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.